So we have our second talk from Jnanavacha here. I'm very, very happy to be introducing Jnanavacha. Jnanavacha is the metric convener for London, for the LBC, East London Buddha Centre. Without going into details, I think one can say this is not an insignificant job. It is a he carries a lot of responsibility there. He's involved with a lot of people. He's got his finger in a lot of pies. You know what it's like when someone tells you about a new typology, a new psychometric test or something, and you go around saying, oh yeah, he's an INFJ, isn't he? Well, I was looking at Jnanavacha through the various Buddha families, and I sort of started thinking, well, he's got to be a Ratna type, hasn't he? Because whenever I'm with Jnanavacha, I just feel blessed. And then thought, well, but he's also got this very strong Padma family. He's so warm and very tender and caring and delightfully light and playful. And I think this is all a bit of a Padma family affiliation. And then thought, but then there's his karma side, isn't there? There's the karma family. He is so, what's the word? He knows how to do things. He knows how to get things achieved. He is very capable. He's got a great deal of uncommon sense, which is why he's got his finger in so many pies in the LBC. And then, of course, there's his Vajra side. He is so clear. He's got such an incisive mind. His name, Jnanavacha, means voice of truth or reality. And he's not only got this mind that sees things very clearly and with depth, but he can express it. He can express it. He's got the vacha, the voice, to express this this truth, this wisdom. And he's also got the gravity that goes with this. He's got playfulness and gravity. And I thought, well, he can't possibly be a Buddha type, but of course he is as well. because he's got this spaciousness that can accommodate all these different qualities and can accommodate many different perspectives. So he's a meeting chair par excellence. I've never seen such a person chair a meeting the way Jnanavacha does, because he holds all these conflicting views and brings them together in some way. So it made me realise that it's quite an extraordinary man, really, to be able to draw on so many different qualities of energy. He has access to many different qualities of energy in this way, in quite a full way. So, yes, I don't want to take up any more time, but I would like to commend Jnanavacha to you, who is going to talk on the River of Fire.
Thank you, Vajrapriya, for a very generous introduction, slightly embarrassingly generous introduction. So I want you to imagine you're in some sort of nightmare to start off with. just indulge me. So imagine that you're in a forest on your own. There's wild beasts around you. You can't see them, but you can hear them. And you know you're being chased. You know those nightmares where you know you're being chased, and you're running and you're running and you're running, and you don't quite know what you're being chased by. But in this case, probably it's a group of bandits or somebody who will do you no good if they catch up with you. And you're running, and you come to the edge of the forest, and suddenly there's this river in front of you. And it's a river that's, well, a very special sort of river, but it's a significant breadth of water between you and the other shore. And behind you, you know that these bandits are catching up with you. What's more, the sun is setting, so the light is going to fade. It's setting on the other side of the river. And the beasts of the forest are starting to feel louder and louder. Yeah? And you're desperate. For a while, there's nothing that you can think of doing. And then you notice that across the river, right across from where you're standing to the other shore, there's a path, not exactly a bridge, but like a bridge, a path, a white path. But it's narrow. It's narrow. It's just a few inches wide. So you're going to have to navigate across this path if you're going to escape from these bandits. And as you contemplate doing that, the river changes. It sort of starts to foam and seethe and become more tempestuous and like a tempestuous sea. And what you realize is that it's no ordinary river, because on one side, on your right side, these waters are raging and engulfing this path, you know, sweeping over it in higher and higher waves. And on the other side, there are flames. There are these flames that are also engulfing the path, and it's like there's a river of fire on your left. So the path is now even more narrow and dangerous. Yeah? But then from behind you, you hear a voice. You hear this voice very distinctly, and it's urging you to cross. It's saying, go forth without fear. Go forth without fear. No danger exists. But if you remain, you will surely die. Yeah? So there's a very clear voice suddenly in the forest. And then you think you hear a voice from the other side, from the further shore. You think you hear it, but you're not quite sure you can hear it. You sense it rather than hear it. And it's a voice that seems to be saying, come, come, just as you are. Just as you are, but with singleness of heart, with singleness of heart, and do not fear the flames or the waves. I shall protect you. I shall protect you. So that gives you heart. So that nightmare scenario, as you stand there, is a scenario that's said to model our situation, our existential situation. The human condition. It's a parable from the Pure Land tradition. It's a parable from the Pure Land tradition that's a school of Buddhism that's particularly practiced in Japan. And each of the aspects of the parable has a significance. So this shore that we're standing on, with the forest behind us, is samsara. It is this world of delusion, this deluded world that we occupy. The other shore, the farther shore to the west by the setting sun, is the pure land of Amitabha, Sukhavati. And it's Amitabha's voice from the pure land that we hear calling us. And from this side, the bandits are chasing us, and the bandits are said to be our wrong views and the views of samsara that chase us and entice us with their false teachings. They promise us material gain, they promise us psychological relief, but actually they hunt us down. And the wild beasts of the forest, are said to be our instinctual passions that keep us bound to samsara. We're hardly aware of them, they come out in the night. And the flames in the water are the flames of hatred, and the waves are the waves of greed. And the path is the path of the Pure Land. It's the path that we have to try and negotiate. And of course, behind us, we heard this voice saying, go forth, and that is the voice of Shakyamuni Buddha. That is the voice of Shakyamuni Buddha urging us to go forth from samsara without fear. So I find this a really evocative image for my life, for the existential situation, because I'm not always aware, in fact seldom am I aware, of life as dangerous, as perilous. I tend to just try and find as much pleasure as I can from the situations that I'm in, and on the whole, I don't do too badly, actually, or so far, and it's sometimes hard to remember that that actually I'm in a perilous situation. And as we heed the call of Shakyamuni, our aspiration grows purer and more powerful. And as we begin to embody the call of Amitabha, we find that the path widens. It widens, and the flames and the waves subside. So, it's particularly that call of Amitabha that I want to focus on in this talk. This call that's calling us, it's the call of Shraddha. It's the call that, or we hear with Shraddha. It's the call of the transcendental, calling us to safety, to bliss, to fulfilment. And without that call, without that other shore, all the techniques and practices that the Dharma offers us seem to me empty. That call, that other shore, is the context for everything. So we can, I think, cultivate as much metta as we like. I might become more and more metaful, but without that call, in a sense, so what? In a certain sense, so what? I think without this call, without this other shore, without this transcendental ideal, Buddhism just becomes another form of sort of psychotherapeutic humanism. Benign, but there are lots of benign ideologies and paths in this world. And personally, I wouldn't want to devote all my life to it. In a sense, self-development in psychological terms doesn't address, I think at least, the existential issues of why am I here? What does death mean? What does it mean to be mortal? Why is there suffering? Why do you carry on living in the face of suffering? And above all, there's no path to wisdom. So Buddhism talks about the transcendental in many, many ways, doesn't it? It talks about the path to wisdom. It talks about the transcendental in many, many ways. And one way is to talk about surrendering to the compassion of the Buddha Amitabha. Yeah. That is a model, a path, a way, and particularly it's a way that's embodied in the Pure Land tradition. I don't know much about the Pure Land tradition, by the way, so I'm not an expert by any means, but I'm attracted by what I hear. To surrender to him, Amitabha, in a way is, I find remarkably attractive, but it's not easy. It's not easy, because to do that, we have to engage with our hearts, with our emotions. We have to deal with the problem of love, the question of love. How much can we love? How much are we prepared to surrender for love? And that's not a straightforward question in our lives for any of us. And that's what I want to look at in this talk. How do we engage with our emotions, particularly these emotions of metta, of love, of altruism, of receptivity, of surrender? How do we engage with those so that we can start to walk this narrow path? So I'm going to focus on three aspects in this talk, and the first is learning to love in terms of learning to love ourselves. The second is learning to love others and widening the sphere of our love, and the third is learning to love reality, learning to love the Dharma. And it's the third one that provides the context for the other two. So although I'm going to come at the end, it's actually, in some ways, it precedes the other two. So the Metta Bhavana practice, in its five stages that we've all learnt, is, I think, in this sense, a context for all of what I'm going to talk about. It's a template for life, that Metta Bhavana practice, isn't it? Starting with ourselves, broadening out to include more and more people, and then in the fifth stage, trying to get a sense of universal loving-kindness, something that's more, goes beyond self, goes beyond egotism, goes beyond self and other. So the reason I say that is that we already have a practice for doing this. We already have a practice, and that's just one practice. We are already trying to do this, although we may not have thought about it in these terms. Firstly, then, learning to love ourselves. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, not because I don't think it's important, but because I haven't got time, partly because also Vajrapriya touched on it yesterday, and I think hopefully you've discussed some things to do with it in your group. One of the things Vajrapriya talked about is metta being already there. This aspect of self-cherishing is already there in all of us. The very fact that we're here means that we care for ourselves in some fundamental way. The very fact that we dress warmly when it's cold means that we care for ourselves, that we think about ourselves. It's innate in us. And Buddhism doesn't make a problem of that. It doesn't say, feel bad about that, don't feel guilty about that. It just says, use that fact to really care for yourself, really cherish yourself, and empathize with others who also really, really care for themselves. So yes, self-cherishing. Look at the ways that we already do that. The main thing I guess I want to say in this section of the talk about ourselves is that we don't have to be perfect to practice the Dharma. In fact, if we were perfect, we wouldn't need to practice the Dharma. And so many times I speak to people back home in London, and I think that the main issue that they're struggling with is wanting to be perfect, almost wanting to be perfect before they start to practice. There's something about lightening up about ourselves, not taking our imperfections too seriously, that can be so, so helpful. None of us is perfect. I don't know a single person in our Sangha that's perfect. There are some very, very impressive people that I do know in our Sangha. None of them, would I say, is perfect. Yeah? Perfection's a sort of abstract ideal. I don't think it's necessarily an embodied human thing. And I think we need to, if we can lighten up, we can start to escape from our self-preoccupation. I was thinking in the silence how, over breakfast, I was thinking, just watching my thoughts and thinking what percentage of my thoughts are about me? And it's embarrassing, isn't it? How many of them are about me? I was thinking, my goodness, it's practically a running monologue about me. Even if it's about, sort of in relation to other people, it's about other people in relation to me, isn't it? So I had this real thought, aren't we all self-preoccupied? I was sort of congratulating myself on that thought, thinking, I must bring it up in the talk this morning. Meanwhile, somebody over the table from me wanted the peanut butter that I was lavishly spreading on my toast at great length. And it was only Sangadeva tapping me on the shoulders, pointing. Who was it that wanted the peanut butter? Yes, that's right. Matt wanted the peanut butter, who was patiently waiting as I was congratulating myself on recognizing my own self-preoccupation, which was great. So it's rather sort of sobering, isn't it? Everywhere we turn, it's about me. Everywhere we go. So if we can sort of start to loosen that and lighten up on that, well, actually, we find it easier. We'll find it easier. I think we'll find it easier. I've just been reading Daniel Deronda by George Eliot, and I thought I'd just quote a little bit, mainly because it's my current reading, and I came across this the other night, and I thought, it's great. Had you caught me a few weeks ago, I was immersed and obsessed in Harry Potter, much to the amusement of my community, who thought I'd lost the plot. So a few weeks ago, I would have been quoting the wisdom of Dumbledore. But actually, you get George Eliot on this occasion. And Gwendolyn in Daniel Deronda is this central character who... She's not particularly nasty, but she's a bit... self-preoccupied, in fact very self-preoccupied, and has had, until she marries, a very sort of cushy life where she's not really had to think about anybody else. And she wouldn't say that she's had a cushy life. She thinks she's had a very, very troubled existence. and had to bear all sorts of hardships. But she hasn't. It's just because she's so self-preoccupied. So self-preoccupied. And when the hardships come, they're all the more painful. Yeah, they're all the more painful. She's gone and married into wealth. She's married a man who she didn't really love. He didn't really love her, but he was wealthy. Yeah. So she's married him knowing that another woman had claims on this man because she was the mother of his children. And anyway, she's starting to feel remorse. I could explain the whole thing, but she's starting to feel remorse. And there's light now because she starts to feel remorse. It connects her again with other people, with the world around her. And Deronda, Daniel Deronda, is this rather spiritual, slightly mystical character. And she says to him, tell me what I can do. Tell me what I can do. How do I escape from this misery? How can I be better? And she's never asked herself that. How can I be better? And it's a lovely moment. She asks him really openly, wanting to know, how can I be better? And what can I do to be better? And he says, there are many things you can do, many things. Look on other lives besides your own. Look on other lives besides your own. See what their troubles are and how they are born. Try to care about something in this vast world besides the gratification of small, selfish desires. Try to care for what is best in thought and action, something that is good apart from the accidents of your own lot. It's fantastic, isn't it? Broaden your perspective. Look at other people. Look at their troubles. Look at some sort of ideal that points beyond self. And she can't take this initially. She goes all quiet and then says, you mean to say that I'm selfish and ignorant? And he responds very wisely and tenderly by saying, he doesn't patronize her and say, no, you're not. What he says is, you will not go on being selfish and ignorant. Isn't that fantastic? Isn't that fantastic? I found that really tremendous, just George Eliot's insight captured in a few lines there. Anyway, I mention all that in terms of learning to love ourselves, but of course it's already pointing towards others. And Bante says, doesn't he, in Wisdom Beyond Words, he says that there's only, in fact, one need of one's own that has to be fulfilled before one can preoccupy oneself effectively with the needs of others. Only one need of our own. And it's not a physical or material need, but simply a matter of emotional positivity and security. We need to appreciate our own worth and feel that it is appreciated by others. To love ourselves and feel that we are loved by others. Yeah. If we can do that, if we can have enough positivity to do that, then we can preoccupy ourselves in a way with the needs of others. Then life, in a way, becomes more straightforward. As Vajrapriya was saying yesterday, his holiday with his partner, when he had a very clear need to care for somebody else, there's a freedom in that, a certain freedom in that. So yes, learning to love ourselves is not enough. It's a start so that we can learn to love others. And awareness of ourselves, awareness of our temperament, awareness of our tendencies, as Vajrapriya has been showing us, is really, really valuable in this. But something else that we can do is we can just practice. Again, Bante says, again in Wisdom Beyond Words, we can practice thinking about other people's needs. How can we meet them? Or if we cannot meet them ourselves, how we can help people to meet their own needs, even when we're also concerned with immediate, objective, legitimate needs of our own. So it's not about martyring ourselves, but how can we start to just give people, other people, a bit more room in our psychic space in our world, a bit more importance, perhaps aiming to even have equal importance, equalising self and other. And Bandy talks about this preoccupying ourselves with the needs of others as the essential revolution of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva vow, he categorises in these terms. He categorises it in terms of, I shall try to see these beings as they are in themselves and see what their needs are, rather than constantly looking to see how they can fulfil my own needs. Yeah? And of course we need positivity to do that. We need a good deal of positivity to do that. And it's worth doing what we can to develop that positivity. One thing that I think I find useful every so often is to just try and dwell on the things that I can be grateful for. I've got lots that I can be grateful for in my life. And a lot of the time I take those things for granted, those people for granted, those conditions for granted. Just look at gratitude. Gratitude is said to be the antecedent to metta. Yeah? So if we can start to just look towards what we can be grateful for, even tiny things, we can start to feel metta. And I think it's, as Vajrapriya was saying yesterday, it's only because we're so caught up in the superficialities, the trivialities of life, that we don't have more gratitude. A few years ago, my sister had breast cancer, and she didn't know whether she was going to pull through or not, come through or not. She did, but she didn't know. And during that year, I had quite a lot of contact with her. I was sort of ringing her most days, having long conversations with her. And she started to talk in ways that were dharmic, instinctively dharmic. She would talk about the beauty of the environment. She rang me up one day to say that a rose had bloomed in her garden on a bush that hadn't bloomed before, and she was full of joy for that. She talked about the snowdrops because she might not see another spring, and she was full of joy and gratitude at having seen them. And it was sort of humbling, well, it was humbling, to think, well, there I am trying to practice. I have been practicing the Dharma for a number of years, and I forget these things. I forget these things. Of course, later on, perhaps, what we can do is start to even see boons and benefits and feel gratitude for people and situations that are really difficult for us, because they can help us grow. Shantideva talks about this, doesn't he? He turns everything on its head in the Bodhicaryavatara. The Dalai Lama talks about this. You know, when asked what he thought of Chairman Mao, he's said to have said, "He is my greatest friend," because there's an opportunity given to us to grow. So, the whole raison d'être for our lives shifts from wanting life to work out to wanting to transcend self. And, of course, this is what Sangha is about, isn't it? It's a field of opportunity that we've been given to grow. And I think when we look back, when Western Buddhism or when the history of Buddhism looks back on Bante, Sangharakshita, one of the things I think that will stand out is his vision of Sangha. His vision of Sangha. It's phenomenal, his vision of Sangha. We've probably barely started to embody a fraction of what his vision of Sangha is. And even that fraction, I feel, is a real gift in my life. It's a real gift. I never thought that I would experience Sangha in this way. I dreamt about it. I sort of fantasized about it even as a kid, but I never thought I could experience it. And it's here. It's here right now. It's all around us. But it isn't sometimes what we think Sangha should be. Sometimes I think that we expect Sangha to be this warm bath of love that we can slip into, and it'll be warm, protective, cozy, nurturing. And Sangha isn't sort of about that. It's not really about that. I've met people who have said, I was ill and nobody in the Sangha looked after me. The Sangha is flawed. It's whatever it is, yeah? And of course, in those situations, you want to sort of hope that we would look after each other. But the expectation is what I'm getting at. The expectation isn't what Sangha's about. Sangha is about an opportunity for us to learn to transcend self, for us to give. It's an opportunity for us to participate in this bodhisattva activity. And what we find, miraculously, is that we're supported in that by others also doing that, who exemplify that, perhaps to a greater degree than we do, who can inspire us in some way or another. So Sangha is a practice. It's a practice. Subhuti talks about it as a practice. Bhante talks about it as a practice. Not something like a warm bath. Although it is immensely pleasurable at times. It's great at times. It is sort of nurturing and secure, but that's not the point. That's what I'm trying to get at. Bhante talks about friendship, doesn't he? So if you want to be have a friend, be a friend. The Buddhism sort of ruthlessly, if you like, active in this way. It's ruthlessly about us taking the initiative, about us taking responsibility. So where does surrender fit into that? Where does surrendering our own will fit into that? Well, I think surrender is a very active thing, because it is about letting go of our own egotism towards something higher or towards another person. Being here is a bit like that, isn't it? We're sharing rooms, we're sharing space, and we can't always get our will. We can't eat what we like. We can't share a room with who we like. Somebody might be snoring, etc., etc. There's a little bit of surrendering. The program might not be to your taste. There's a little bit of surrendering of will. And it has a taste of freedom about it, if we can engage with that. I live in a community, I've lived in a community for a number of years, and it goes on, this constant, all of us, eight of us, sort of trying to both have our way and surrender our will with each other. Do you know what I mean? I share a room with Maitreya Raja, we share a bunk bed, he's on top, I'm on the bottom. We sort of negotiate our way through that room. He's actually very, very patient and giving. He's very, very tolerant, actually, Maitreya Raja, which I benefit from. And I kind of try and reciprocate as much as I can, sometimes not so successfully. He's very, very different to me. He bounds out of bed in the morning. I never bound out of bed. He's meditated and gone for a run while I am still having my sleep, in a way. And he's back and sort of bouncing around. And I tolerate all that as I turn over in my bed. And recently he's taken to writing his dreams down. Which I can sort of understand. Well, no, I can't, actually. I can't understand any reason to wake yourself up if you don't have to. But he, in the middle of the night, is now writing his dreams down. And the other night, he obviously didn't want to turn the light on or whatever to do that. And so he was trying to write his dreams down in the dark. And it was the most noisy writing that I've ever heard. I mean, every bit of paper was being rustled around, turned over again. Even the pen was scratchy, really, really noisily. And I tolerated that, at least until the morning, when I told him. I had to tell him in the morning. But there is this constant kind of give and take. And I think it's particularly important for us to be plugged into Sangha in this way if we don't have other responsibilities in our lives. Most people out in the world, perhaps a lot of you here, have families, children, people that you need to look after, care for, be responsible for. But a lot of people in our Sangha don't have that. A lot of people in our Sangha are single, independent, and able to pretty much move around, do what they will. Yeah, they might not be very wealthy, but they're pretty independent. I include myself. And for us, people who don't have those sorts of ties and responsibilities, the danger of selfishness is greater, yeah, than for a lot of people out there in the world who aren't explicitly trying to practice a spiritual life, but do have all sorts of responsibilities to other people. Do you know what I mean? So there we are, doing our metta-bhavana sometimes, and I think we don't realise, some of us, how good we've got it. In a way, how good we've got it in not a very helpful way spiritually. Yeah. So I think plugging into Sangha for us, if we haven't got that, is vital. Yeah. We need to learn to care for each other, to give, to surrender our will to each other in that way. I'm not saying that having a family and a relationship is the only way out. It might not be the best spiritual thing to do. But on the other hand, sort of selfish individualism isn't a path. Yeah, it never has been in Buddhism. But surrender involves more. I'm going to read you a little bit from The People of Loving Kindness. So we're going into the Sufi terrain. Just those first few stanzas. We are the people of loving kindness, guides for one another. Through the purity of love steps, all helpers for one another. Though embodied in different bodies, we are a single spirit, heart and soul, possessors of the hearts of one another. We are one people, with no you and I, only we, all equals in love, all beloveds of one another. So there's a real passion in this. It's not just tolerating somebody's noisy writing in the dark. There's a real passion that's being urged. We are possessors of the hearts of one another. Yeah? All beloveds of one another. And the beloved is, of course, the divine in the Sufi tradition, is another word for the divine, for the ultimate. And we are that for one another. There's a real passion in there that I think a lot of us in the West, men, don't feel, apart from perhaps in our sexual romantic relationships. Perhaps sometimes we have that sort of passion for our lovers. In a sense, the spiritual life is asking us to have that sort of passion, that sort of passion, that sort of love, but in an unattached way for all beings. That is the passion of the Bodhisattva, the love that a mother has for her only child in the Metta Sutta. Yeah, the passion that we might sometimes feel for our sexual partners. And it's, of course, it's much harder to do when there aren't the bonds of family or sexual attraction. Yeah, to do it for each other when there aren't those bonds is much, much more demanding. Much, much more demanding. But if we don't try, if we don't move in that direction, Sangha sort of is no more than, well, at its best, some sort of support group, yeah, of a bunch of individuals doing their own thing. I don't know if you saw The Kite Runner. Did you see The Kite Runner or read the book? Just beautiful film of friendship, of brotherhood. Two young kids, friends, actually brothers, but they don't know it. And the love that they express for one another is just delightful, delightful. And, you know, one goes off to run a kite, which means chase a kite that's fallen to the ground for the other one, all as part of this sport in Afghanistan. And, you know, one says to the other, will you get the kite for me? And the response is, for you 1,000 times over. For you 1,000 times over. What a beautiful line. It's straight out of Rumi in a way, isn't it? For you 1,000 times over. And that is sort of embodied. Not perhaps for us, but there are cultures where it used to be embodied and it perhaps still is embodied. That sort of sense of brotherhood. That sort of sense of brotherhood. Love is a self-giving of person to person, even a surrender of person to person. Surrender here, meaning the complete abandonment of any advantage derived from the use of power. So a complete abandonment of any self gain. That's from Bhante again. So, I mean, maybe that all feels very lofty, but I like that vision, at least, of how brotherhood could be, how sisterhood could be, what the Sangha could be like. Again, from I'll read you the Sufi saying, and it may sound over the top. It may sound something like you might whisper to a lover. But in the Sufi tradition, this isn't being whispered to the lover. It's being whispered to the beloved in the sense of the spiritual friend, the embodiment of the divine. And the saying goes, if you went to paradise, I would go, of course. But if you went to hell, hell would be paradise. A paradise of rose gardens, just because you were there. Isn't that lovely? Isn't that just beautiful? Imagine feeling that. Imagine just feeling that for one other person. For one other person in an altruistic, unattached way. So that's lofty enough, isn't it? Lofty enough, perhaps. But again, it's not enough. From the Buddhist point of view, that's not enough. Because learning to love one another only makes sense in a higher context of the transcendental, learning to love reality. Learning to love reality. So that's what I'm going to come on to. So the responsiveness to reality is, of course, called Shraddha. Shraddha. And it's a response that might be faint or sometimes even underground, but it's said to be innate in us. We wouldn't be here if we hadn't felt it. We've had some sort of response to reality. We wouldn't be here. But what's more, it can be cultivated. Sometimes people say to me, oh, I don't get Shraddha, or I'm not that sort of type. And it's a bit like saying, oh, I don't get kindness, I'm not that sort of type. It's something that we can cultivate deliberately. And ultimately, perhaps, it becomes a response of our whole being that's conscious. But often, it's more underground than that. But it is innate. It is innate. And of course, there's lots of ways of cultivating. We can reflect on what's important in life. We can meditate on what's important in life. We can reflect on the qualities of the Buddha. We can reflect on the qualities of the Sangha. We can reflect upon the qualities of our spiritual friends. We can reflect upon death. The other day I was meditating. I shouldn't do this, but I'd open my emails before meditating. Never do that. Never open your emails before meditating. And I'd had this rather unpleasant email criticizing me. And it was sort of mild, but unpleasant. And that's another thing. Let's not criticize each other by email. Let's not do it. Let's just not do it in the Sangha. Email is not a good tool. For that. And so I sat down to meditate, feeling a bit sort of hurt, aggrieved, sorry for myself, felt that I hadn't been seen fairly. So I was trying to do my sadhana, Manjigosha, supposedly in front of me, etc., etc. But actually what was going on, this person was wrong, I was right, etc., etc. And I just, I suddenly remembered that the night before, the evening before, I'd heard that Heath Ledger had died. And Heath Ledger, you know, the actor, you've probably heard. And he probably sort of embodied, not that I'd thought about it very much, but somebody in a god realm, you know, young, beautiful, successful, the world at his feet. He was 28, and he died. He died. And I suddenly thought of his family and what they must be feeling. And suddenly there was metta. There was metta for him, his family, suffering generally, for the person that had sent me this email, for myself. And there was Shraddha. In just connecting with the universality of dukkha, there was Shraddha. Ah, yes, the Buddha Dharma is the way. Is the way, and Manjigosha was there. Yeah, Manjigosha was there. So just reflect on what's happening all around us. All the time it's happening. You know, They don't all make the headlines, but it's happening. And study. Study can really help us develop Shraddha. We live in this culture of trivia, don't we? Of cynicism and trivia and shopping and it erodes these shoots of Shraddha. It just erodes them. And I'm really, really prey to all of that. Not cynicism, but trivia and shopping. And I was out with John. John, where's John Denton? Yeah, we're developing a friendship, John and I, but we went shopping. Actually, we went shopping to buy Simon, who's there. We were going to buy him a present. And before I went, and we were going to buy him a present because it was his birthday. And we decided to go to this designer. I decided that we were going to go to this designer clothes shop and buy him a nice shirt. That was on behalf of several of us in the community. And before I left the community, I said to my tribandit, you know, I've never got into designer clothes. I'm not into clothes particularly. That's one aspect of craving that I've never got into. Isn't that good? And so then off we went with John to a shop off Bond Street. And suddenly all these shops were so beautiful. These shops and these shop assistants, you walk in and the shop assistant suddenly, it's not like M&S. It's like, you know, what can I do for you, sir? And we found this shirt for Simon, but we also, well, we walked out with a pair of jeans each. And I didn't need a pair of jeans. I certainly didn't need a new pair of jeans. And I certainly didn't need a new pair of designer jeans. And yeah, they were cheap, but not that cheap. You know, cheap for designer jeans, as it were. And the shirt didn't fit Simon anyway. So there's this complete kind of sucked in so quickly. And all of that erodes Shraddha. The Bond Street erodes Shraddha. Every advert that we see, Bhante says, is an advert against Buddhism. Yeah, because it's trying to promote greed, hatred, or delusion. Or all three. So we need to just be on guard for the views that we're holding, the messages that we're receiving from the culture around us, and really be sharp to that. So often people come up to me with their theories about, I don't know, the Dharma or whatever, or life, not the Dharma, and it's just rehashed from our culture. So for example, take the notion of hierarchy. We live in a culture that's very anti-hierarchy, that's really pro some sort of levelling out, where we're all equal. But each of us thinks, oh, we've discovered that for ourselves. We've suddenly discovered this anti-hierarchical streak in us. And you think, well, where does that come from? It doesn't come from, you know, some sort of super rational working out of life. It's just from the adverts. It's from Pop Idol and all the rest of it. Do you know what I mean? And besides, it's not true, is it? It's not true. How are we going to learn the Dharma? How are we going to become better human beings unless we can look to other people who can exemplify that for us more? Yeah? Yeah? I mean, of course, there's bad sides of hierarchy, but you know what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about authoritarianism. Ritual, devotion, gratitude, all of those things are anti our culture, aren't they? Puja. I mean, we engage in puja, but puja is a real practice. I found myself thinking this last night. I was enjoying it, and then I was thinking about something else. And I think, actually, it's really a practice, not just to say the words, but see if we can mean them. With Mandarava, blue lotus, and jasmine, you know, with all flowers, pleasing and grateful. You're offering these to the divine. How often do we actually feel that? How often do we feel those words? Yeah? I confess all my faults. May I become, you know, that which maintains all beings. Just tremendous words. These are words of the loftiest ideal that I've ever encountered, probably that any of us will ever encounter. And we sit here of a Saturday evening often, well, I do anyway, and I recite them as if they're nothing. They're nothing. So reverence and receptivity are something that we can cultivate. Gratitude is something that we can cultivate. Longing for the divine, for the transcendental, is something we can cultivate, is something that we need to cultivate. Not just longing for an Apple Mac, which I John also has an Apple Mac. My motto is basically, don't go shopping with John. that's what this talk will somehow boil down to. That's a sort of subtext under everything else. we need to cultivate this longing for the divine. He who conceives of the spiritual life as a means of attaining eternal bliss has not understood. The whole conception of attainment is fundamentally wrong. One has simply to break down the barriers of his separative individuality and allow himself to be penetrated by everything that exists. Then he will himself penetrate everything. This mutual penetration is liberation, is happiness. That's Banti, yeah? Again, from Wisdom Beyond Words. This notion that I can sort my life out, even in spiritual terms, is fundamentally flawed. Only we may pass through the veil of the royal pavilion, all of us inextricably linked, all sympathizers with one another. Again, from the people of loving kindness. Only we may pass through the veil of the royal pavilion. I take the royal pavilion to be the divine, the transcendental, and the veil of our ignorance. And we can pass through it. I can't, you can't, we can. The bodhicitta, Bhante says, is more likely to arise in a collective. And why is that? Because the heart of the bodhicitta is about self-transcendence. How can that be achieved individually? What does that mean, individually? So Pure Land Buddhism, Shin Buddhism, takes this other approach. It says, okay, well, I can't transcend myself, so I'll surrender myself to the will of the transcendental, as it were. And it's poetry. You must take it as poetry. It's not metaphysics, but it's good poetry, and the poetry has truth. So Amitabha is the embodiment of the divine. And you, of the transcendental, and you surrender your will to the transcendental. You surrender everything to the transcendental. You start off in this tradition by recognizing that we, or you, or I, am a fool. Yeah? The word is bonbu, which I quite like. So we're bonbus. So we're a fool. We can't do it alone. How can we do it alone? We're conditioned, we're deluded, we're being bombarded by delusions all the time. We're blundering around in life. We're fools. But then the second point there is that Amitabha's compassion has already saved us, just as we are. Just as we are, Amitabha's compassion, the transcendental, has saved us, accepted us, just as we are. He's already embraced us in all our imperfections. The power of compassion has transcended all our imperfections. So again, poetically, there's something really true about this. There's dangers there, but I'll not focus on them just yet. So out of gratitude, it's not because we want to be saved, because Amitabha has already saved us, but out of gratitude, we open ourselves up to his grace, as it were. Yeah? As it were. And what you do in the Pure Land tradition is you chant his name. You chant his name. You say, Namu Amida Butsu. Or in Sanskrit, that would be Om Namo Amitabhaya Buddhaya. Which means, I entrust myself to the Buddha Amitabha. And that's all that you do. You chant his name. But you really mean it. And it's said to be the name that calls. So you chant his name, but he calls you. The name calls you back, and you have to open up to that hearing. You have to hear the voice that responds. And it's a deep hearing that we require, a call that speaks to the depths of us. And in a way, nothing is required from us other than that deep hearing. There's a saying that because of this way of viewing the spiritual life, it's easy. It's easy because, in a way, there's nothing for us to do. But there's also a saying that's from the Pure Land tradition that says, although the path is easy, few are there to take it. Although the path is easy, few are there to take it. Because it's radical, this notion of giving up our own will. Voluntarily giving up our own will. a complete surrendering of egotism. Rumi puts it really well. Rumi says, light the incense. You have to burn to be fragrant. To scent the whole house, you have to burn to the ground. Isn't that fantastic? To scent the whole house. So next time you offer a stick of incense, think in those terms. See if you can. You have to burn to be fragrant. And that requires courage, honesty, perhaps paradoxically a kind of determination to walk the path that will burn us to the ground. Willingly walk that. Each of us is pledged in devotion to sacrifice ourselves for the other. All candles and moths, all roses and rose gardens for one another. That's again from the people of loving kindness. All candles and moths. In the Sufi tradition, that's an image. A moth being drawn to the candle is an image for us being drawn to the divine. It will burn us. It will destroy us, annihilate us, and there's a liberation, a spiritual rebirth in dying to egotism. I don't know if you've seen the film Sunshine. It's been one of my favourite films last year. Not very many people I've spoken to liked it. I loved it. I thought it was just great. I've seen it 3 times. I'm going to show it at the Buddhist Centre. It's a bit violent. I should warn you. It's a bit violent. And at one level, it's this... science fiction, horror, thriller, a la Alien or whatever. But at another level, it's a metaphor for self-surrender to the transcendental, to the divine. You've got a group of astronauts. You'll forgive me for this sidetrack. You've got a group of astronauts on their way to the sun. There's 8 of them heading towards the sun. The sun is dying. It's 2057. The sun, because of some freak weirdness, is actually dying. And all life on Earth will die with it. Unless these astronauts can get close enough to the sun to eject a bomb, a nuclear bomb, into its heart to try and reignite it, to try and spark it up again. And they're heading towards this sun. And you just get this sense of awe and wonder of the magnitude of the cosmos, of this ball of fire that is the source of all life, but is also utterly annihilating. You only have to look at it and it will kill you. It will burn you to the ground. There's this sense of majesty as they're heading towards that to save all life, to save all life on Earth. And of course, all sorts of weird things happen. All sorts of things go wrong. Some of them go mad. One of them starts to see the sun as God. Yeah, which is very, very interesting. He starts to see the sun as God and decides that it would be wrong to interfere with God's will and try and reignite him. If God has willed that we should all die, we should all die. And he proceeds to sabotage the mission, kill people, do all sorts of things. It's a fantastic image for fundamentalism meets theism gone very wrong. Yeah, as people, you know, as he sabotages things and thinks he's doing God's will. And at the end, Cillian Murphy, who you know will survive till the end because he's the best looking and the biggest name, at the end, so I'm not giving much away, he survives until the very last bit, as it were. He manages to, in this fantastic image, he touches the sun. He touches the sun. And just imagine what that's like. The film is just beautiful, ravishing, beautiful to look at, and awesome to sort of contemplate. He touches the sun. And as he does so, in that moment of annihilation, it's all slowed down because apparently space and time get warped, etc. Anyway, but never mind that. As he touches the sun, there's this look of bliss on his face. In that moment of annihilation, he is the moth to the candle, extraordinaire, par excellence. He touches the sun and reignites it. Isn't that fantastic? Isn't that fantastic? I thought so. Rumi again. I groaned. Be quiet, he said. I was quiet. He said, groan. I grew feverish. He said, be calm. I grew calm. He said, I want you to burn. It's fantastic, isn't it? Fantastic. What sort of relationship must Rumi have had with Shams, his spiritual teacher? What sort of relationship must he have had, this beloved? Okay, so I'm going to have to conclude. So I'm nearly there. So there are dangers in this approach of self-surrender to the transcendental. There are dangers of, theism, for example. It can start to sound like God, can't it? And theistic literalism. If we forget that it's imagery, if we forget that it's poetry, if we take it literally, it can sort of start to go wrong on us. It can also lead to complacency. In that we don't have to do anything, theoretically. I just lie in bed, turn over, Maitre Raja does all the running, and I'll be saved by the grace of Amitabha. And for a greed type like me, that's really a danger. That's really a danger. I was on solitary retreat last year in Mallorca. Most people go into some wilderness. I went to Mallorca. And it was a bit of a wilderness. It was a mountain valley in Mallorca, but very beautiful, very warm. I really got inspired by Milarepa. Milarepa is perhaps the greatest ascetic that the Buddhist tradition has ever produced. I was reading his songs sitting on a sun lounger with sometimes with ice cream, sometimes with orchata, which is this Valencian kind of milkshake drink flavored with hazelnuts. And I was thinking, oh yes, how true, Milarepa, how true. Really excited. So there are dangers that certainly I have to watch out for in this approach. Bhante says that passivity is not to be mistaken for receptivity. Passivity is not to be mistaken for receptivity. The wet clay is not the open jar. The wet clay is not the open jar. I was thinking of Tom's pint of Guinness. So the wet clay is not a pint of Guinness either. But never mind that. So yes, there are dangers, but there are also this poetic truth. And somehow or other, even if this approach doesn't grab you, somehow or other, what I'm trying to say is that we will have to engage our emotions in the spiritual life. It's not enough for Buddhism to seem like a good idea. And when we say engage our emotions, when I say engage our emotions, I mean those passions and also those hatreds, but certainly the deeper emotions, those instinctive emotions that drive us. We're going to have to navigate across that river of fire, that river of water. We're not going to do that without engaging our emotions somehow. But of course, this Shraddha, this longing, this surrendering, is itself not enough, or it's only a means. It's a means to a realization that transcends self and other. Yeah. So it's not just about other power or about self power. It's about a transcendence of that dichotomy. The truth won't fit any of our models. It's not going to fit into a conceptual framework. This notion of every aspect, every phenomenon in the universe interpenetrating everything else, of us being completely interconnected and yet distinctive, is not going to be open to our rational minds. It's something that can be directly experienced. And Buddhism is fantastic in that, unlike other mystical traditions, perhaps, it's offering us tools and techniques and practices and sangha so that we can directly experience that for ourselves. And that feels a goal to me worth dedicating all our passions to, all our emotions and energies to. The answers to what is death, why am I here, aren't going to just pop up to us, but they will reveal themselves in our engagement with the Dharma. They will reveal themselves in our engagement with life. So I'm going to finish with... I'm going to finish with two things. The first is a little verse from a Pure Land devotee called... Asaraha Saichi, and he in this little verse of devotion, where he chants the name of Amitabha, he links it with wisdom, with emptiness, and it points to the union of wisdom and compassion. Let me just I'll read you it. The Buddha Dharma is Namu Amida Butsu, in emptiness. The air. How happy I am to meet it. Emptiness. The air is Namu Amida Butsu. I am in the midst of emptiness. Namu Amida Butsu. So there's something in that, isn't there? There's a flavour of that, the air. How happy I am to meet it. There's wisdom in there. He's pointing to something from direct experience, even though it's not graspable. Even though it's not graspable. So finally, very, very finally, I'm going to finish with the last three stanzas of this poem that we've been looking at, The People of Loving Kindness, which from a Sufi point of view says the same thing. Yeah, in different imagery, it's saying, I think, something very, very similar. If you call upon one here, all will say yes, for all have one name, one breath, all striving with one another. Our abode is the house of love for you, full of passion and music. We are melodies, reed pipes and lutes for one another. O Nurbaksh, it is from being free of any ego that we are so feverishly caught up in serving and dealing with one another.
It's a splendid talk. It really drew on such a range. You have such a range. You've got the tickle and the punch. You've got the Padma and the Vajra in there. And I think it was a splendid compliment to the talk yesterday. You got the passion and you got the strong outward focus. So, I'm very, very grateful to you for that.